Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us today. I want to make an announcement very quickly. Of course, normally at this point, early in the show, I'd be telling you that we'd love for you to join us by watching on Facebook Live. Our internet. Chris tells me our internet has just come back up. We were without internet for about the last hour. So if you do want to watch the show on Facebook Live, which so many of you have started to do, just go to the GPB News app on Facebook or the GPB News page on Facebook, and you'll find us there. And, of course, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Either way, we want to hear what you have to say as we go through today's show. It's Wednesday, which means that Greg Bluestein, lead political reporter, he always cringes when I say that, but the fact is his byline is there constantly. That's not your official title. That's what I call you, of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Greg.
How's it going?
Good. I'm glad you're here. We got plenty of news to talk about in the Georgia election cycle right now.
Job security.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Julianne Thompson, Republican strategist, longtime leader in the Georgia State Republican Party. Hi, Julianne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And it's great to have you here. And Eric Tannenblatt, another Republican. We've got a table full of Republicans today, Eric Tannenblatt.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, also runs the Global Government Relations. Is that what you call your?
Global Public Policy.
Oh, Public Policy at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. We're going to get to the Sam Nunn interview later in the show because we want to talk about state politics first. But I did have a long conversation with Sam this morning, and he had some interesting remarks to make about the Trump-Kim summit. But as I say, we'll get to that later on in the show today. Greg, let's start with what is breaking news from the gubernatorial campaign trail, but not altogether surprising news.
Yeah, that is that former Governor Roy Barnes, who was probably Stacey Evans' biggest supporter, highest profile supporter, I should say, has now endorsed Stacey Abrams, another sign that she has almost completely consolidated Democratic support in her run for governor. And that tends to happen when you win by 50 plus points in the May primary.
Why is that somewhat surprising to us? I mean, we know that we should say, of course, Governor Barnes endorsed Stacey Evans, tried to help her on the campaign. He's one of the first Democrats to come out and endorse her. But we shouldn't be surprised, should we?
Not really. I mean, he endorsed a year ago, and it lent Stacey Evans' campaign some instant early credibility, legitimacy, that belief among some Democrats that she really had a shot to beat Stacey Abrams. He talked about at the time, the competing strategy that we heard about so often, which is the ticket, the deal for Democrats is they should appeal to moderates who have fled the party. Well, Stacey Abrams proved that she got both moderates who fled the party and liberals in this 50 plus point victory. But he got a lot of pushback from Democrats after that endorsement, who called him a Dixiecrat, who brought up some of his more conservative or moderate policies back in the late 90s and early 2000s and tried to use that against him. So, there were some who said he took it personally, and there were some folks around Evans who were a little bit surprised that he endorsed Abrams. But, hey, he endorsed her, and they let bygones be bygones, and now she's got the last sitting Democratic governor on her side.
Julianne, with the Democrats consolidated in the way that they are now around Stacey Abrams, is the victor in the GOP gubernatorial runoff going to face a tougher road than maybe would have happened 4 or 8 years ago?
I think it depends on who wins. Who wins the runoff? But I believe that Republicans are going to coalesce behind the eventual winner. I believe that Georgia is going to remain red as far as our statewide elected officials are concerned. And it's not a shock that Governor Barnes has endorsed Stacey Abrams.
I agree. Look, he not only was he the former governor, but he was also the last gubernatorial nominee when Governor Deal got elected. And, you know, the Democratic Party is now consolidated. And, you know, Stacey Abrams ran a very progressive campaign. She's going to need to appeal to the middle, and having people like Governor Barnes is going to be helpful in that. But I agree with Julianne. I think at the end of the day, after the Republican runoff, Republicans will all consolidate around whoever the nominee is, and Republicans will ultimately win.
I mean, you mentioned that 2010 race. There was the same, you know, it was a very bitter race between Nathan Deal and Karen Handel. You know, just a fraction of a percentage point between the two, and yet Republicans still managed to consolidate and elect Governor Deal. So that I guess is something of a template of how this could go.
Let's turn to the Republican governor's race. Greg, we talked about it, of course, on Monday. You were a part of, you and Richard Belcher at Channel 2 News broke what seemed to be a pretty big story. And I'm not sure, I kind of thought back to our show on Monday, and I'm not sure that I walked our listeners through it in quite the way that they deserve to hear it. So if you don't mind, let's back up and talk about what this story about the secret recording of Casey Cagle by former opponent Clay Tippins. Help walk us through exactly what that's all about, because you have an update on that story in the paper today.
I do. So Clay Tippins sits down with Casey Cagle 2 days after the May primary, and unbeknownst to Casey Cagle, he has his iPhone in his front pocket, and he presses the record button. And they have a pretty lengthy conversation that touched on a different issues, but among them was a 9-minute dialogue about Clay Tippins' uncle, Lindsay Tippins, who was doing most of the session, the chair of the Education Committee, and Clay is asking Cagle what happened with his uncle.
And let's explain what the bill that was the point of the conversation was all about. This was a measure that would have increased funding to charter schools to a record high of $100 million.
A little nuance there. It would increase the private school tax credits to $100 million from $58 million. The Senate wanted it to be an increase, but much less of an increase, to $65 million. And Lindsay Tippins and Cagle were pretty much on, it seemed like they were on the same page about a more marginal increase. The House wanted the $100 million increase. And the opponents say basically that's $100 million less that could go into public education and other things because this is a tax credit.
The per student ratio of money for public schools would have been less than the money that went to the chartered kids, the kids who were not in the public system, if this bill had gone through, which it eventually did.
Yeah, and that's sort of a separate issue, too, that they were fighting about. So there's two bills that they were really talking about. But the recorded conversation pretty much focused on the private school tax credit, Cagle tells Clay Tippins essentially that he told his uncle, Lindsay, repeatedly, this is not about policy. This is about politics. This was, in fact, in his words, bad public policy, but he had to do it. And when Clay, kind of using his tactical questioning skills that he developed from being a Navy SEAL, he sort of goaded him into an answer when he was asked, like, why did this have to happen? Why was it so important to you? Cagle says, well, I had to do it because I had to prevent Hunter Hill from getting outside money from a foundation called the Walton Family Foundation that was prepared to give Hunter Hill, who was then, you know, tied for second place for a little part of it with Brian Kemp, $3 million, in his words, $3 million. Now the foundation says this is unfounded. You know, they've really declined much comment other than saying that they didn't give any money to either candidate, and this is unfounded. This is all speculation. And Cagle himself has said that I was talking about rumor and innuendo. But whatever, you know, the case may be, he did tell Clay Tippins that because we have it on a recording of it. And then recently, this week, Lindsay Tippins went on the record, said really he was so hurt. I mean, in the middle of our interview with him, he took a napkin and dabbed his eyes. I mean, he got emotional. But he said he always trusted Casey Cagle as a friend, and that Casey Cagle personally let him down when, not only with this private school tax credit bill, but also his another bill that increased funding for charter schools. By about $20 million, and in some cases increased the per pupil student funding ratio above about a third of what is now spent and at about a third of public school systems. So this really kind of got him. And he said not only did Casey Cagle tell him that about Hunter Hill, but he also said that this foundation would personally help Casey Cagle's campaign to the tune of $2 million if he passed this charter school bill. So again, we asked Cagle's campaign for comment. They did not refute that he said that. They had no comment on whether or not he said that to Lindsay Tippins, but they did say that he has always been a champion of more school choice, and that Lindsay Tippins had tried to block legislation like this, and he was tired of it.
Thank you for walking us through that. All right, Julianne, this is great for TV, radio, for print. I mean, it's a secret recording. It's just... you can just about make out what Casey Cagle is saying. You've got to have words on the screen, really, to understand it. So this is a good media story. Mary Margaret Oliver, a Democrat, sat in the studio on Monday and talking about this, and she was more shocked by the fact that the recording was made than about the what the actual substance of it was. I don't mean, and I don't want to put words in her mouth. Certainly she wants leaders to be honest, and she said that. But she was put off by the notion that people would be walking around with their iPhones turned on to record down there at the session. So I want to talk about that a little bit. But more immediately, do voters care about this, or is this just a great story for the media?
Well, they absolutely care in a runoff. We've talked before about a runoff not being the same as a primary. If this were a one-on-one race between Brian Kemp and Casey Cagle in May during the primary, I believe Cagle would have won. But this is the runoff. And this particular recording has really hurt Cagle in the eyes of a lot of the base who is going to turn out the vote. It has mobilized the Hunter Hill people for obvious reasons behind Kemp. It has mobilized the Clay Tippins people behind Kemp, and Michael Williams has come out and endorsed Kemp. So it's really mobilized a lot of the base behind Kemp over Cagle. So it's going to be a matter of ground game and grassroots mobilization. Who is going to get their voter out? But to think for 1 minute that voters don't care about this, and to think for 1 minute that it's not going to affect the outcome of the runoff, I think, is very naive. I think they do care.
So, Eric, what I think Julianne is hinting at, without having put it in these words yet, is this has to do in some ways with the split in the Republican Party. It's happening not just in Georgia, but in states around the country, and we'll talk about that in a little while, between the more conservative activists who want a firebrand, like a Brian Kemp, who's comes at the campaign in more of the Trumpian kind of mold, and a Casey Cagle who they see as representing more of the establishment Republican Party. So I think Julianne that it is part of why you say in a runoff that this is going to be more significant because of just that. Which of those Republicans will turn out, mobilize to get out to vote for their candidate?
Well, I don't know that I would. Look at it as Trumpian versus non-Trumpian or Trumpian versus establishment. I think you got to just look at these two candidates that are running, and Julianne is absolutely right. The rules are so different in a runoff. Every little thing matters, especially a runoff in the middle of the summer. People aren't paying attention that the people that are going to go to the polls are going to be the activists and the people that are really passionate about a candidate. And right now, the Kemp supporters smell blood. They see that this is an opportunity for their candidate who came in second place to perhaps win. And you have people on the Cagle side that are a little scared at the moment because they don't know what this is going to mean for the election. So the dynamics of the race are very different in a runoff situation.
So I misrepresented you, or am I still right?
Well, when I think you're right to a point, but I wasn't saying that it has anything to do with the Trumpian versus.
Well,
the non-Trumpian.
I shouldn't have said Trumpian, but you're hoping that the Kemp voters are going to get more enthusiastically behind him.
I'm saying that the other candidates' voters are coalescing behind Brian Kemp, the others that
gotcha.
Did not make the runoff.
Okay.
And like Eric said, the rules are very, very different in a runoff than they are in a primary. And it's all about who gets their base of support out to the polls. And usually that is the most ardent of conservatives that will show up to run in a runoff in July.
Well, right. Yeah. And to the Trump point, though, I will say that, you know, 90+% of Republicans support the president. He's very popular among Republican primary voters and runoff voters in particular.
And you're starting to see, back more to the Trump point, you're starting to see the rhetoric change a little bit between the candidates, where they are hitting each other over Trump and over each other's perceived lack of support for Trump, when in fact, neither of these candidates were very vocal Trump supporters, at least early in the 2016 campaign. Casey Cagle endorsed Jeb Bush, and Brian Kemp kind of stayed out and said at one of the debates that he was never even asked to formally endorse Trump. But both of them are now, trying to be standard bearers for the pro-Trump movement.
Yeah, yesterday morning I turned on my computer, and the first thing that popped up was a direct mail piece from Casey Cagle email that said, Donald Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize.
I saw they put out a news release on that, Greg. They got that out there almost before the summit was over.
Yeah. And again, I mean, just like Eric said, our polls and other polls show Donald Trump remains tremendously popular among core conservative voters. And when you have a runoff turnout that might be lucky to scrape double digits, and I hope it's above double digits, but that's what matters. And for Kemp, you know, with this policy over politics messaging that he's going to be pushing against Cagle, I think he's going to target it in the rural areas that he really succeeded in, especially South Georgia, where he won a bunch of counties in Southeast Georgia. And also, what's interesting is he's really making a play for Hall County. I mean, at least his social media messaging is reminding Cagle that, you know, Hall County might not be locked up for him. And of course, Cagle's from Gainesville.
Yeah.
And he did not care. He won a majority. He won a plurality of Gainesville, but he did not carry Gainesville by more than 50% vote. He got about 49% there.
And the newspaper.
He got a blistering from his local newspaper after the recording came out,
saying voters deserve better, or we deserve better than this. Just to reemphasize the Cagle's effort to get behind Trump after the summit, he initially tweeted out, or it was tweeted out from his campaign account, the liberal media can't imagine praising at real Donald Trump, even on this historic occasion. We're with you, POTUS. Great work. And then the news release, excuse me, with this quote, President Trump has already delivered more than President Obama did when he was awarded the prize early in his first term. There's still much more work and much negotiating to come, but we have reason to celebrate a commitment to peace and a reason to believe that our president should win the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, Eric, the only problem with that is I get it. It makes sense. You want to get behind the president when you're in a runoff like this. But this is the sort of thing that, if things fall apart, can come back and really snap at you in a way that it's a potentially unintended consequence if before the November election, this all falls apart and Kim starts testing again.
Sure. But right now we're living in the moment of a runoff, and both of these gentlemen have to win the Republican primary runoff, and they're going to do whatever they need to do to best position themselves.
Greg, is Brian Kemp going to have the money to run a media campaign? He can only rely on you in the media. There's only so many stories that can be done in the weeks ahead about this secret recording. At a certain point, the campaign is going to have to come up with money to emphasize the message. Are they going to have it?
And that's Cagle's biggest strength. And that's where he, right now, you're seeing him lay it on. Not only has the Cagle campaign now run at least two ads, there might have been three, at least two ads, one positive about Cagle, one negative about Kemp, but also outside groups, including that just spent about a quarter, before all this, had already bought about $250,000 worth of ads, just debuted it yesterday. It's a negative Kemp ad. So this is where the Cagle campaign really has a huge leverage, a huge advantage over Kemp. Kemp's folks are thinking that some more Republican traditional donors are starting to hedge their bets and back both candidates. We won't know in the media until after July, when the latest reports come out. But he has a lot of financial ground to make up.
Yeah, but again, in a runoff situation, television is not the be-all, end-all. You know who your voters are and who you have to get to the polls, and there are things going on with digital advertising, yeah. telephones, mm-hmm. mail, emails. That is direct voter contact, mm-hmm. and TV's very expensive. And if I had limited resources, I would be going after the ID'd voters and getting them to
turn out. Is that what they're doing, Julianne? You watch this stuff more closely, I think, than any of us.
I think that's absolutely what they're doing, and Eric has hit the nail on the head. And I'll tell you something else that the Kemp campaign has going for them is Jeremy Brand, who is known as one of the leading political consultants in a runoff situation. He has almost like 100% record of winning runoff elections that he's worked on. So he knows how to get out the vote, and I'm sure that grassroots mobilization is what they're concentrating on.
All right, let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, let's talk about how the Democratic candidate for governor, already decided, Stacey Abrams, is trying to take advantage of this secret recording. We'll do that after this message.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Ooh, drive away. Ooh, drive so far.
Greg, it's not only Brian Kemp who is trying to make hay out of this story. Stacey Abrams' campaign is piling on a little bit on this, too. They've announced they're going to do a town meeting tonight, I think.
Yeah, directly seizing on this issue. Now, she throughout the primary always cast herself as the public education governor. We've heard a lot of gubernatorial candidates call themselves the education governor. She added that keyword public before it. Tonight, she's having a public education town hall at her campaign headquarters with teachers, administrators, voters, parents, all sorts of stakeholders to talk about public education, K-12 education. And she wants to make the point that, in her words, she'd never hand over public taxpayer, privatized school districts is what she says. She'd never help use public taxpayer dollars to privatize school districts.
Eric, I asked it a couple of minutes ago of Julianne. Let me, now that we've talked about Stacey Abrams, her efforts on public education. Once the Republican contest is decided, do you think that this issue of public education, and even if Kemp is the nominee, well, I guess that's not fair. If Cagle's the nominee, is this issue going to haunt him all the way to November? And can Stacey Abrams take advantage of this?
Well, I would imagine that in a general election, all issues are going to come up. You know, we're going to hear about, you know, some of the financial issues surrounding Stacey Abrams that right after she won the nomination, the RGA was putting out ads. So I think you'll hear issues from the primary, that'll bubble up in the general election. But I think that, you know, both candidates have, you know, records on education. They both held office, Cagle longer than Kemp. And I think their records are going to be, fair game, just like Stacey Abrams' record is going to be fair game.
I agree. And let's not assume that the vast majority of Georgia voters are public education only voters. I mean, they are the school choice in Georgia. It polls extremely well. And when it comes to charter schools and the charter school amendment, if we look back on that, I mean, it's something that polled well and did well across party lines. So I just don't see that as a winning strategy.
Okay. We're starting to get comments on Facebook Live. Greg, one of them is from Dee Dee Montgomery Murphy. She says, can't wait to hear about the story Jim Galloway wrote about today, his interview with Lindsay Tippins. You alluded to it briefly a couple minutes ago. You were both there, I think.
Yeah.
It took place in Lindsay's living room, right? Because he's down the road from Galloway.
Yeah, from Jim. And we met in his living room. And again, as I said earlier, Dee Dee, he got emotional. And I don't know Senator Tippins all that well, but I imagine he's not someone who gets emotional too often. But he talked very passionately about what he called a betrayal from Casey Cagle, someone who he endorsed. He endorsed Casey last year and stuck with Lieutenant Governor Cagle even after his own nephew got in the race.
Well, let's tell one quick story about this, because I thought it was one of the things that jumped out at me when I was reading about the interview this morning. One aspect of this, and I believe, I don't want to get the two bills confused, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Greg.
His interview is mostly about charter school bill.
Charter school bill. Lindsay Tippins, as education chair, wanted to hold a lower ceiling on how much state money would go to charter schools. I mentioned it earlier. The notion was that the equation right now is such that charter school students are really getting more per pupil funding from the state than public schools are. He wanted to keep down any effort to give too much money to the charter schools. Cagle said in this that there was a bill that would have increased it to $100 million. Cagle met with Tippins, and they came to an agreement, according to Lindsay Tippins in the interview. He said, okay, you're right, Lindsay, heck with politics. I'm sticking with you. You can let that bill come to the floor as education chair because we're not going to give them what they want.
And he might have used a curse word instead of the word heck.
Yeah. Lindsay Tippins took Cagle's word for that, according to Lindsay. The bill came to the floor, and immediately the amendments were added to the bill that took it right back to the place that Lindsay Tippins did not want to go, and he felt the whole thing had been engineered by Cagle.
He felt used, and that was the main thing. And when you ask Lindsay, you know, when he talked about when Cagle initially said, you know what, the heck with the money, the heck with the outside stuff, you do what your principals say. He said he felt like a 1,000-pound weight had been lifted from his shoulders. He felt like that's, he's in his words, he said, that's the Casey I've always known. So he felt vindicated in a way for trusting Cagle at first. And then when this amendment gets tacked on, and he said it was even like screened by the charter school advocates first to make sure it was good with them. When he said he just... That's when he felt disenchanted and said, you know what, my resignation's already in your desk drawer. Take it out. I'm done.
Eric, you have been in the halls of the legislature for many years. You were Sonny Perdue's chief of staff when he was governor. This may have an impact on how runoff voters respond at the voting booths, but this is the way politics gets played quite often at any state legislature, doesn't it? You lift the veil and suddenly it becomes really kind of shocking to some people. But this is what happens.
Well, you hope to think that, you know, this doesn't happen, but I'm not, you know, naive.
Oh, come on.
No. I mean, I'm not naive. I will say, though, that, you know, things are not always black and white. And, you know, I wasn't privy to the conversations between Senator Tippins and Lieutenant Governor Cagle. And I also know that Senator Tippins is a big supporter of public education and has not had a record of being very supportive of charter schools. And I don't think we want to get into a charter school debate, but I do believe that there's a little bit more detail with regards to what the bills would actually do. And I think to make broad statements like you were going to give more money to charter schools and less money to public schools, that's not exactly what the bill did.
Well, it didn't give less money to public schools, but it did increase the per pupil funding
in the example
to charter
used
schools
in that one district. But
well,
there's
overall by about $17 million.
But there's
overall
also things that public schools get that charter schools don't get in terms of things like, you know, bonding authority and things that because they're not part of a school district.
And I think it's nice to talk about all of these things, but the average voter doesn't get down in the weeds like this. They hear politics over principle. They hear, I want to keep my opponent from getting millions of dollars. And that is how they make their decision.
Julie,
I agree with you.
I think you are so right on target. If there was one sentence that emerged from that tape and the first story that you and Belcher did at Channel 2, it was, this isn't about policy. This is about blanking politics. That's the line that resonates, right?
I agree.
Okay. By the way, we're getting some interesting comments on Facebook Live. We mentioned Casey Cagle thinking the president deserves a Pulitzer. Well, I mean, the Nobel
Peace Prize. Nobel.
Jose Perez writes, I hate, in all caps, I hate Trump. But if things keep going okay, then I think a Nobel Prize for the three presidents involved, Moon, Kim, and Trump, of course, South Korea, North Korea, and the president, is reasonable and a way for the world to support the peace process. All right, so I wasn't ready to make a turn to that yet, but That's a really interesting comment, and it's going to be interesting to see how it's going to be reflected in the approval ratings for the president. Are people suddenly going to say, well, we're not sure about Trump, but this is a big deal?
Well, I think this is, I think it is a big deal.
Well, I understand, but right. I'm talking, okay.
I'm not sure what your question is.
What I'm saying is this a turning point for President Trump, and that wall of opposition, the never Trumpers, are suddenly going to be reevaluating and saying this is a good thing for the world?
Oh, I think most definitely. I think any time a president does something that is noteworthy like this and significant like this, people step back. I mean, you can look at the approval rating of presidents after wars and how their approval rating goes up. If there's something that's, you know, going well in the economy, how their approval ratings goes up. And people dismiss other issues when they look at the bigger issues. And I think right now the reason why President Trump's approval rating is so high among Republican voters is that they're tuning out the liberal media and the left, and they're looking at the accomplishments. And there are quite a number of accomplishments since he's been president the last 2 years.
That's right. People are looking at this as a foreign policy victory, somebody who wants to bring peace to an otherwise horrendous situation in North Korea. They're looking at the economy, which is booming, job creation at an all-time high. The stock market's doing well. And people are happy with what's going on in their personal lives. They feel safer today than they did a couple of years ago. So I think President Trump is winning.
Okay, we're going to come back to that when we play the Sam Nunn interview. Greg, Brittany Burnett, I direct this to you because who knows, maybe she's talking about you, maybe all of us. She says, oh man, I've never watched before on Facebook Live, just listened. No one looks like what I expected. Thank you, Brittany. I know I probably sound a lot older than I look. Greg, let's talk for just a minute about the primary elections that took place yesterday in a number of states. There were some really interesting results, and in some cases they were good news for the president, in others, bad news. Probably one of the good news stories for the president was Mark Sanford, who, of course, has a storied history as former governor of South Carolina, went out for his walk on the Appalachian Trail, ended up leaving office in disgrace, but made a comeback running for Congress and winning. But he has not been a pro-Trump member of the Republican conference up on the Hill. And it really hurt him yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, this was a South Carolina politician who had never lost a South Carolina race in his history, who has a striking winning streak. And who represented, as South Carolina district goes, you know, a somewhat more moderate South Carolina district based in Charleston, and he had largely voted with President Trump, but also had issues with some of Trump's rhetoric, and had, you know, kept them at arm's length on some issues. A challenger, a first term state legislature, who challenged him, ran as an ardent pro Trump supporter, who said that Mark Sanford, in her words, offended the president, and as such, cut Charleston and that district out of negotiating tables. And she ends up ousting Sanford, who had never lost an election before. And she also got Trump's election day endorsement, where Trump had a really striking personal tweet urging voters in South Carolina and in that Charleston-based district to vote
at
for
4:15 in the afternoon.
Suggesting that Mark Sanford should go back out on the Appalachian. Well, a little both. Yeah. Julianne, that was good news for President Trump. And, you know, despite all of his problems, Mark Sanford had remained. People in South Carolina liked the guy.
Well, apparently not enough to.
Right.
Well, let's not discount some of the things that Katie Arrington has going for her, though. I mean, yes, the President Trump support and the President Trump tweet pushed her over the edge to a victory. But let's not forget about the fact that voters are more informed than ever when it comes to being involved with policy and being dissatisfied with someone that they feel is not representing them well. And let's not discount what I'd like to call the Nikki Haley effect. South Carolinians love strong, conservative Republican women.
Yeah, we remember she, of course, was governor of South Carolina.
Yes, she was. Yes, she was. And I believe that 2018 is going to be the year of the Republican woman. We don't see as many of them as what I would like to see, but that's all going to change. And women are coming forward, more and more strong conservative Republican women, and they're being embraced by voters. And I was extremely excited about her win.
And I should also note, too, with the Nikki Haley comparison, Nikki Haley was also a state legislator, had only been in the legislature for a few years, and ran against the good old boy system. And, you know, Mark Sanford's been a fixture in South Carolina politics for a long time.
The other race that was particularly interesting was in Virginia. The Republicans had a primary contest for the right to take on Tim Kaine in the U.S. Senate. Kaine, of course, having been Hillary Clinton's running mate in the last election cycle. And the winner, Corey Stewart. Greg, my feeling is that Tim Kaine couldn't have asked for a better result. Stewart is a very, very conservative. It's more than that. He's just conservative. He has supported Confederate monuments. Said we have to stand up for the heritage of the South. He's made comments that some people find relatively offensive. He won. And yeah. He won, you know, he's going to take on Tim Kaine. Who knows what's going to happen there? But I can't imagine a state like Virginia electing him.
I mean, it's going to be a really interesting race because you've got two candidates who are focused on energizing their base. On one hand, you have Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's running mate, running against, sort of an arch conservative who also energized the core Republican voters in Virginia. So there's not much room for middle ground there.
This is the thing that's going to be interesting there is if whether the Virginia race becomes part of a nationalized movement. And is the race going to be nationalized or is it going to be more localized?
And there was just a 1% difference, I think, between the two candidates.
Yeah, but
just
he won. A little,
he won. But Nick Freitas that he was running against wasn't exactly a moderate or a liberal Republican. He was a very conservative Republican as well, but probably not as much of a firebrand.
Exactly. Galloway had a really interesting observation about this. He says that with Stewart in Virginia, as a guy who thinks Confederate monuments are an important part of the history of the South, running in that race, and Stacey Abrams here running a race about, you know, getting rid of the Stone Mountain carvings, he thinks it's going to set up an interesting scenario about where the South stands on that kind of issue. And I think that's an interesting idea. We'll see how that develops. All right, let's get another break out of the way. I want to get Sam Nunn's interview on the air as soon as we come back, and then I want to get your response to what Senator Nunn had to say. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, the tradition of Black athletes taking a stand. Journalist Howard Bryant's new book, The Heritage, traces athletes' political and social advocacy back to Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali, and others. He'll tell us why athlete activism disappeared, how it came back, and was complicated by the patriotism of the post-9/11 era. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Julianne Thompson, Eric Tannenblatt, Greg Bluestein in the studio. In the aftermath of the summit, the Singapore summit, I could not imagine anyone whose thoughts we would rather hear today than former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, one of the great lions of the United States Senate, a conservative Democrat, and who in his post-Senate life went on to work just feverishly on nuclear disarmament and on ending nuclear proliferation. And so I thought it would be important to hear what he had to say about what happened in Singapore. So here's a bit of that conversation. We're going to let it play out a little bit, but the entire conversation will be posted on our website. But here's Sam Nunn.
Bill, let me back up a minute and just take just a moment for background and perspective. We had a bloody Korean War, which everyone's familiar with. It's red history. Hundreds of thousands of people killed. We've had several presidents try to stop the North Korean nuclear program over a long number of years. All of those efforts have been sincere, but they have failed. And 6 months ago, we had, very dangerous rhetoric between the leader of the United States and the leader of North Korea. Anytime you start tossing around nuclear threats, it makes everything more dangerous. And so if you look at where we were 6 months ago and where we've been, I think we are better off now than we were. And I think we have to give credit to President Trump. We have to give credit to the North Korean leader. And I would say we have to give a great deal of credit to the South Korean leader, President Moon, because he has really taken the initiative. But there are huge gaps. And the agreement that was signed was really just a symbolic more than anything else. I call it a faith, trust-based agreement. It has huge gaps. So it's enormously important we don't start spiking the ball on the 50-yard line. And there's a long, long way to go.
You know as well as anyone that in the 1980s, President Reagan put into the popular vernacular the concept trust but verify. And it strikes me that in watching the Trump news conference, we're really not, we certainly don't know of any reason to think that we've got a plan that gives us verification. And right now it seems to only be the president who feels trust in Kim. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think we have to put a little discount on some of the things the president is saying about Kim. He is, as we know, very effusive in his praise, and he is can be brutal in his criticism and his threats. So some of this is showmanship, but to the extent that we look at what degree of trust should be there, I would say that President Reagan had a good formula. I would say in the case of North Korea, based on the past, we should say to ourselves, don't trust and verify.
How do we look back, as you've done, at the agreement that the Clinton administration put in place, that the George W. Bush administration put into place, both of which seemed to slow down, if not stop, North Korea's nuclearization program. How do we look back on those and believe now that something different is happening?
That's a very good question. I would say that we have had these pledges before. In fact, President Carter actually had when he was no longer president in 1994, he had a long discussion with President Kim's grandfather, Kim Il-sung. And I've read the account of that, talked to President Carter about it, and he the grandfather went further with his pledges than we've seen so far. But, of course, it didn't happen. He died not long after that. So I think we have to understand that this is a very tough type negotiation. It's just started. I would say that if Churchill were here, he would say this is the beginning of the beginning, certainly not the end of the beginning, and there are huge gaps. Just for instance, the definition of denuclearization, that has not been agreed on. We know what President Trump means. In fact, they were citing 2-3 weeks ago the Libyan model. Well, the Libyan model is totally inaccurate and inept here because Libya didn't have any nuclear weapons. They had centrifuges. They were building the infrastructure. So they were able to put that those things on the airplane and fly out. Nobody's going to get on an airplane with a North Korean bomb. It's got to be dismantled by the people who put it together. Otherwise, the safety hazards are huge. So this is a vast difference, and a whole lot of work is going to have to be done on the ground. I would start with the definition of denuclearization. The security guarantees have to be spelled out that North Korea seeks. We're going to have, I think, a firm and verifiable pledge by the North Koreans and implementation of stopping all nuclear weapon material production, and we're going to have a complete inventory of their weapons of mass destruction production and what they have. You don't know how to in any way verify what's been destroyed, dismantled, or removed if you don't know what the starting point is. So all of those things have to be done. Can they be done? Yes, but it's very, very important that the people in the Trump administration understand that this is just the beginning and the hard work is ahead.
The first step, I assume, is we need to know have a catalog of what weapons they have right now, correct?
Not only weapons, yes, but also weapons usable material that could be converted into bombs. And of course, that catalog has to be verified. And this is where Senator Lugar and I made a suggestion in a recent article we wrote, and we also had discussions at the White House on this subject, and that is the experience we had in dismantling and safely handling thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons and chemical weapons after the breakup of the Soviet Union. The United States and Russia worked together as partners. We had it, we called it cooperative threat reduction. And together, with our help, with scientists and scientists working together, military people working together, we were able not only to accomplish the mission, three countries got rid of all their nuclear weapons, and dramatic reductions were made in the in Russia. So that's an experience that is not exactly like North Korea, but it will tell us a lot if we just pay attention to it. And one thing it tells us is the best possible form of verification beyond what we call national technical means is people on the ground working together, engineers and scientists talking to each other. That's where you really learn about the program and what's been produced and where it might be.
Greg Bluestein, I let that play out a little bit longer than I normally would because I don't think we could ask for a better, straightforward explanation of where we stand with all this than Sam Nunn just gave us.
Exactly. I mean, the most striking thing to me about that interview was the quote about Winston Churchill, which is, this is the beginning of the beginning. I mean, Trump is declaring victory, and that's politics, and it is what it is, but this, you know, we might not know exactly how fruitful these were for months, maybe even years. And right now, the Secretary of State is meeting to hash out some of the details. But we've seen this before in the 90s and the 70s. We've seen different sorts of promises and assurances, and it remains to be seen. And again, we might not know for four or five more years whether or not a total denuclearization, in our view, is happening.
The other thing I thought was worth our hearing again for people who may not have been as aware of it is President Trump certainly, we understand the personality of President Trump. He likes to take credit for a lot of things. He's great at patting himself on the back. He certainly did that in the news conference, Eric, following the meeting with Kim. But to say that no other president could have done this, history really doesn't bear that out. Both the Clinton and the George W. Bush administrations did, in fact, have agreements on nuclear weapons with North Korea. Clinton was apparently poised to go to North Korea, but he ran out of time. He went through impeachment, and then his term ended before he could get anywhere with it. It's not the first time, and none is right to remind us that we've got to make sure this works the right way this time.
Yeah, and I thought it was also, you know, good for Senator Nunn, who clearly is very knowledgeable, to acknowledge the fact that we're better off today than we were 6 months ago, and that obviously there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but he acknowledged that we're in a better place today than we were yesterday. And I think that that's good. But let's now, you know, move forward and do the diligence that's required that he just talked about. But I don't think we should, put down the fact that President Trump got us to where we are right now.
No, I agree with everything that Eric just said. The meeting was the beginning of a clear victory for peace. But what I want to make sure of is that we don't go down the same path that we did for the Iran nuclear deal, where it is an agreement that President Obama had ratified by the UN, which allowed the U.S. Constitution allowed for us to leave that. What I want to see is a treaty. I want to see this to go a lot further, eventually become a treaty for peace. And at that time, we'll know that it is a real victory for peace. But you cannot discount the fact that Donald Trump did this and that he did a great job. And I know that there are people for political reasons that don't want to give him credit where credit is due, but he deserves credit for this. And like he said, like Sam Nunn said, we're better off than we were 6 months ago.
You know, Greg, it's an interesting point that Julianne makes. We are so divided in our politics right now. We are so ready to think the worst about the people on the other side of the equation. And it has been hard. There are conservatives that are having trouble swallowing some of what happened in Singapore, for sure. But it is so hard for the anti-Trump forces out there to take a step back and say, gee, if he gets us to a place where there really could be a lasting agreement, the man does deserve some credit. And I will say, and then you respond to all of this, to some extent, he brings that on himself. His comportment in the news conference didn't help people who don't like him already give in and decide he had done a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and about 6 months ago, he was also the one who tweeted about bringing fire and fury to North Korea. So you know, while Sam Nunn says we're better off than 6 months ago, is also because of the enhanced rhetoric from 6 months ago that both the North Korean leader and President Trump were part of. But yeah, look, I mean, not just the nuclear part, but also this is a war that ended in 1953 without a formal peace treaty. So if there is some sort of conclusion to that war, wouldn't it, you know, with South Korea and China involved too, because both of them are parties to that horrible conflict. This would be an unbelievably tremendous resolution.
All right. Well, we'll watch all of that unfold in the months ahead. Again, if you want to listen to the entire interview that I did with Sam Nunn, we'll post it on our website. Just go to gpbnews.org, look for the Political Rewind tab, and Olivia Rheingold is already making plans to get it posted up there. He had other observations that you might be interested in hearing as well. Hey, before we leave today, a couple of quick notes, everybody. Ernie Suggs, one of your colleagues at the AJC, talked with Andy Young recently. You know, we know that Andy has gone through some pretty major health issues. It started in Nashville about seven weeks ago. He was hospitalized here at Emory University, had a blood infection that led to other problems. And I think everybody's been worried about Andy Young. He's a giant in civil rights. Mm-hmm. He's 86 years old. Ernie Suggs reports after talking to him, Andy Young is still funny, still laughing, and still telling stories. Admittedly, says Ernie, the former Atlanta mayor and United Nations ambassador is doing them a bit slower. He quotes me saying, I'm doing very well. I have another 10 days of antibiotic treatment. I needed 3 months to recover from the last 60 years. That sounds so much like Andy, Eric.
Yeah, it does. It does. And we wish him a speedy recovery.
That's exactly right. We wish Andrew Young well. Keep listening to the show, Andy. And when you get really recovered, want to have you back on as soon as possible. That's all the time we have for Political Rewind today. Eric Tannenblatt, Julianne Thompson, a real pleasure to have you back with us, and we look forward to having you. When we go to 4 days a week, starting July 23rd, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, all because our listeners have been so supportive and enthusiastic about the show. Greg Bluestein, you know we always love having you here on your Wednesday appearances on Political Rewind. Couple of notes. We're back tomorrow on Two-Way Street with a really interesting show, I think. An author named Jim Jordan. He's from Savannah. He's written a book about a slave ship that landed on the shores of Savannah, right off Jekyll Island, in 1858, the first slave ship to land in 40 years. It was illegal at that point, but a businessman named Charles Lamar in Savannah wanted to bring slaves in. He brought 400 African people in. And this is a story about what happened, how that all began, what happened to the incredibly sad Africans who were brought in bondage. We'll talk about that and a little bit about the history of slavery in the United States on Two-Way Street tomorrow. Then, of course, we're back on Friday with another Political Rewind. So we look forward to seeing you all then as well. Thanks for being with us today. See you soon.